This is The Rotunda, your podcast about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.
We don't want them here. We want to ensure that we are not admitting into our country the very threats our soldiers are fighting overseas.
Donald Trump's executive orders causes widespread protests across the country.
I think it was ill-founded to start with, and it also most likely violates the Immigration and Nationality Act and the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution.
That's Florida immigration attorney Elizabeth Ritchie. Also on the program,
the House came to us with an initial budget that was higher on Visit Florida than the Senate budgets and pulled us up to their number. Okay, so what's changed?
State Senator Jack LaValla is wondering why the House is suddenly interested in tightening Visit Florida's budget belt.
Let me tell you guys, I live here on this lake. I spend more time on Lake Okeechobee than just about anybody, and this lake is not a toxic lake. It's not a bubbling cesspool of green, blue-green algae. There's not dead fish. There's not dying manatees.
Professional angler and television host Scott Martin is here to defend Lake Okeechobee against a spat of negative press. All that and more coming up on episode 92 of The Rotunda. Welcome to the program. So protests erupted over the weekend following President Donald Trump's executive order to suspend refugee resettlement, including an indefinite ban on Syrian refugees and individuals from seven countries: Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. Those are all predominantly Muslim countries. So was it a Muslim ban? That was the question of the week. The Trump administration says no. But if you listen carefully to former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani during his appearance on Fox News, he sort of explains why the original intent was a ban on Muslims, they found a way to make it pass the smell test.
Okay, talk to me.
I'll tell you the whole history of it. So
all right.
When he first announced it, he said Muslim ban. He called me up, he said, put a commission together, show me the right way to do it legally. I put a commission together with Judge Mukasey, with Congressman McCall, Pete King, whole group of other very expert lawyers on this. And what we did was we focused on, instead of religion, danger. The areas of the world that create danger for us.
So this argument might have held up and lasted a bit longer if it weren't for another step that went a bit too far to include those who are allowed to be in the country legally.
So this executive order was very broad brush. It applies to anyone from those seven countries. So even if you were a green card holder, maybe you even had your naturalization case pending, you yesterday anyway, on Saturday, would have been barred from entering the United States.
That's immigration attorney Elizabeth Ritchie. She's based in Tallahassee. We met up to discuss the uproar just as the White House was pushing back against a New York federal judge's order to temporarily block part of Trump's plan.
The federal judge out of Brooklyn ordered that the order be enjoined. In other words, that anyone who had come in to the country as a refugee on Saturday would not be deported. But it does not apply much broader than that. It's just a preliminary injunction. So we are only seeing this at the very, very beginning stages, and there's a lot more to do. There will be a lot more litigation about the constitutionality of the whole order.
Speaking on a lot more litigation, like, you know, it was powerful to see lawyers filing their habeas corpus briefs on sitting on the ground at the airport, at JFK, and airports around the country.
But no one, the seven countries that were named were not did not have anyone from the countries that carried out either the 9/11 terrorist act or the Boston Marathon bombing. So I think it was ill-founded to start with. And it also most likely violates the Immigration and Nationality Act and the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. So we saw people up in arms literally at these airports protesting. They're very unhappy, and people who are refugees who were going to be turned away, and some of whom were turned away yesterday, already went through a 2-year vetting process to get that refugee status to be able to enter the United States. So to say that we're going to impose extreme vetting, there's already extreme vetting going on. If we want to extreme vet someone, it should be in a different context, but not for refugees. No refugee has ever committed an act of terrorism or been charged anyway with an act of terrorism in the United States.
So as an immigration attorney, explain the vetting process for those who don't know. For someone who is trying to get into the country, what is that like?
For a refugee?
Yeah.
Sure. So a refugee, the process to become a refugee is about 2 years, and it takes place abroad. There are personal interviews done. There's an investigation done of the person's background. Even personal acquaintances are interviewed. The person goes themselves for an interview and a background check in person with a consulate or an NGO abroad. If a question arises, a legal opinion is requested, and then if the person is deemed eligible about the end of that 2-year process, they're granted the status, then they can come to the United States into one of 5 airports where they undergo one more test to be able to enter the United States. So it is our most comprehensive vetting process in existence as far as immigrants go.
What about visas? Those who are attempting to obtain a visa and other types of status?
Sure. Other visas are not nearly as closely vetted as refugees, but for example, the 9/11 hijackers, many of them came over on student visas for schools that didn't even exist, and that's what created the CVIS program that's in place now. So it is much more comprehensive than it used to be. The San Bernardino woman who killed all those people around Christmas time, she came over as a K visa. People who are on Ks or student visas or other types of non-immigrant visas, they go through a background check in their home country and an interview before being granted the visa. And it is not a right to enter the United States if you're not a citizen. It is only for citizens who have that right. So there is the belief by some that this order was legal because it applied to non-citizens, but it did in fact also apply to dual citizens of the United States who were also entering on their alternative passport. And for those reasons, we think that it is unconstitutional and violates the Immigration and Nationality Act.
What about those who are legal? We're seeing others who went through the process, permanent residents, those who hold green cards.
Right.
How come they're being ensnarled and caught up in this sweep?
So this executive order was very broad brush. It applies to anyone from those 7 countries. So even if you were a green card holder, maybe you even had your naturalization case pending, you yesterday anyway, on Saturday, would have been barred from entering the United States until the judge ordered the stay. And the problem with that is that these people have already gone through tremendous background checks, and they're not a threat to security, which is what the president is saying he based his order on.
So the Trump administration made several attempts to clarify while doubling down on their crackdown. Trump issued a statement Sunday insisting that the executive order is not a Muslim ban. Here's the rest of my conversation with Tallahassee-based immigration attorney Elizabeth Ritchie.
Again, if there were a question about security, none of the people from the 9/11 hijacker countries were one of those 7 countries. Saudi Arabia was not one of the 7 countries.
Yeah, I can attest to the whole process. Being from Guyana, Georgetown,
mm-hmm.
Guyana, in South America, going through and obtaining permanent residency and utilizing the green card,
mm-hmm.
and then eventually becoming a citizen. And none of that process is easy. And starting that process in the home country of
right.
Guyana, I was too young, my parents did all of this. It was going to the embassy, several visits, back and forth,
fingerprints, mm-hmm.
interviews, and all of that stuff. It was not, here you go, you're entering
right.
into the country.
It's
so
not an easy process.
To
all.
See these people
right,
after going through that.
Who
yeah.
have a To say a valid reason is an understatement. I mean, these people are fleeing persecution. If some of them go back to their home countries, they will be killed. They will be imprisoned. So these are the people that America wants to and should continue to protect, and that's what we've done for the last 40-something years with our humanitarian program. But yesterday, that changed.
So what will happen next? What's the legal grounds, as an attorney, between this back and forth with the administration. We've seen some success with the ruling, but we're hearing the White House, as I said earlier, they're planning to continue in force, and even Donald Trump's own statement saying that, oh, it's, everything's working out smoothly.
Right. There's nothing smooth about it. There's been tremendous chaos across the country just in the one day since the executive order was issued. We've seen another judge out of Virginia issue their own order regarding the executive order. So this is just the beginning of litigation. It's going to get more complicated, more litigious. And I think that to say that we can implement this executive order in an orderly way is impossible when each and every green card holder from one of those seven countries will have to ask for a special waiver upon entry. That will throw airport security and catching flights completely out of whack, and it will be a huge inconvenience and a tremendous expense.
I know you have some clients that you're representing who are pretty much concerned about their livelihood. Students, I'm thinking about my students that I've had who have done projects about Syrian refugees and all of that stuff. I'm thinking about her right now and the worry that she's probably going through about her own status.
People are very worried. I have relatives who are worried. You know, Florida is a port state. We have a tremendous number of cruises coming in and out of Florida, and someone from one of those seven countries may have left on a cruise last week that's coming back to port today. They're very worried that they're not going to be able to re-enter the United States. As far as Tallahassee, we've got FAMU, FSU, TCC, a lot of students from those countries. Those seven countries are afraid about, are they going to be able to see their families again? They're not willing right now to leave the country, not knowing if they're going to be able to come back, and will their families be able to come and visit them? That's still an open question.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. I'm establishing new vetting measures to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the United States of America. We don't want them here.
What, in your view, what's the right way to do this extreme vetting that the president is asking for, that you know is already in place? How do we solve this? I know this is a big question. How do we get out
question.
Of this?
Yeah. It's a huge question. Well, we solve it through the law and being logical and orderly and not with a knee-jerk reaction and orders that are not based on facts or law. And we have to go and continue to honor the American way, and that is being a global leader, honoring humanitarian values, honoring the law. And I think that's what we're seeing judges recognize yesterday and today, and we'll continue to see that as litigation ensues, that the law will prevail and it won't be emotion.
That's immigration attorney Elizabeth Ricci. You're listening to The Rotunda. Did you know you can donate to this podcast? Yes, for all of you loyal listeners, no matter your level of contribution, it's all welcomed. Visit rotundapodcast.com, find the donate button, it's on the top right, and show your support for what we do here each week. From one controversy to the next, Visit Florida is back in the spotlight, even as it's under new leadership following the last fallout from a secret $1 million deal with rapper Pitbull. Now there are new reports by Naples Daily News that the agency gave out multi-million dollar contracts to a former agency executive who now heads up a national destination marketing organization called Brand USA. All right, so while lawmakers were back in Tallahassee, House Speaker Richard Corcoran again questioned the massive budget the agency, Visit Florida, has been receiving in recent years.
What was the rationale for jumping their budget from roughly $25 to $28 million a year to $80 million a year? Why all of a sudden, in one area of governance, do we have in essence, 200% jump in a budget? Why don't we have that 200% jump in education funding? Why don't we have that 200% jump in tax relief, whatever it might be, that's probably more beneficial to the people of the state of Florida.
But not so fast. Over on the Senate side, Senator Jack Latvala made it clear that continued push to approve budget increases for Visit Florida originated in the House.
It's important to remember the budget process the last 2 years, because that was my subcommittee. Both of the years, the House came to us with an initial budget that was higher on Visit Florida than the Senate budgets and pulled us up to their number. Okay, so what's changed? Have they had a remarkable middle of the night epiphany on that, or were their numbers and their thinking bad last year?
Now, how about sending some of that money our way? The Rotunda could sure use a million or two. Visit RotundaPodcast.com. In fact, why isn't Visit Florida sponsoring the Rotunda? We'll have to work on that. In the meantime, you yourself can support this program with your generous contribution. Let's turn our focus to the Everglades. The Senate Environmental and Natural Resources Budget Subcommittee heard an earful from residents who live near Lake Okeechobee. They traveled to Tallahassee to speak out against a proposal by Senate President Joe Negron to fast-track and buy some 60,000 acres of land south of the lake to clean up and restore what's left of the Everglades.
If the plan is successful and it goes through, we're talking about the closure of yet another sugar mill in the Glades area.
Tammy Jackson Moore is with the Guardians of the Glades organization.
Over a 20-year period, the Glades has given up more than 100,000 acres of active farmland in the name of Everglades restoration. In doing so, we've closed down three sugar mills. One sugar mill employs 600 people.
Committee Chair Senator Rob Bradley filed Senate Bill 10 to implement Negron's proposal. Here he is discussing the possibilities of the plan with Florida Department of Environmental Protection Deputy Secretary Drew Bartlett.
Proper staffing and resources, would it be possible to move up the planning for South of the Lake storage without disrupting current projects?
All these things can be moved left or right, you know, it's all depending on how it wants to get funded.
While some citizens express support for Negron's plan, lawmakers from North Florida say their environment would like some attention as well. They formed a coalition called Stand Up for North Florida. Here is State Representative Jay Font, a Republican from Jacksonville.
And my great concern is that North Florida and North Central Florida are already derelict in terms of receiving funds that is shared by the state for the environment. The notion of sending billions of dollars to an unproven land grab in South Florida for potentially dubious results continues to leave the rest of Florida alone.
This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes.
Florida, the Sunshine State. Its balmy winter climate and natural beauty have made it America's vacation land.
Well, this documentary by the Weather Channel starts off pretty nice, but it soon goes negative in its coverage of the blooms that popped up last year.
This coastline looks beautiful at a distance. Up close, it's a different story.
In Florida, we have a state of emergency and at several beaches. People are now being urged to stay out of the water.
Marinas closed, beaches empty.
When I watched this documentary, it really bothered me. And I wanted to kind of do this video to kind of tell you a few things about Lake Okeechobee, some of the things that I see, and again, some of the things that bothered me with some of the terms and the words that this documentary used. You know, one is the title of the video, Toxic Lake Okeechobee. Let me tell you guys, I live here on this lake. I spend more time on Lake Okeechobee than just about anybody, and this lake is not a toxic lake.
Professional angler and TV host Scott Martin saw the Weather Channel's portrayal of Lake Okeechobee and promptly filmed his own video to share a perspective from those who live and thrive on the lake.
Some clips that we just filmed recently and even a few months ago of what I see, the Lake Okeechobee that I see, the beautiful fishery that I get to spend my time on and thousands of people come down to our lake here and enjoy this resource, to enjoy the great fishing and watch the bird life and see alligators. And there's more manatees in this lake than I've ever seen before.
To help share their stories, we have Scott Martin joining us via phone, along with the executive director of the Clewiston Chamber of Commerce, Hillary Highslope. These guests are here to share how Lake Okeechobee plays a significant role in the economy of the Treasure Coast and surrounding areas. Let's start with Scott Martin. Scott, your living depends in part on a healthy, vibrant lake, but the Weather Channel's release of that scathing video titled Toxic Lake, the untold story of Lake Okeechobee, was not well received by many in the Lake O region, including you. Tell us about that.
Sure. You know, there's several things that really bothered me about that video. You know, one was the timing of it, coming into season right now, and to have a video get aired on television across the country depicting Lake Okeechobee as a toxic wasteland and showing signs of algae at the coast. That not only hurts us and our communities around the lake for our tourism, because this is the time, these are the next 6 months that we need to have tourists come down here and enjoy our beautiful town and our community and our lake. And then they watch this and they think it's going on right now. And that's a very bad thing. And to be honest with you, I would expect that it would hurt the tourism dollars on both coasts as well, because I'm sure people would say, let's don't go to South Florida. It looks like they have some kind of toxic algae going on. So that was the one reason that I really was bothered by. The second reason is that Lake Okeechobee is not a toxic wasteland. You know, it's a vibrant lake full of life. And so to use words like toxic wasteland, and it was very, very unfair. And so that bothered me very much. You can hear me say this, but just go to my YouTube video and read the comments. These are just random people, hundreds and hundreds of comments of people saying, backing me up, saying, I was just there last week. I was just there this last summer. I was there three times last year. It was an amazing place, a beautiful fishery. They didn't see these things that the Weather Channel, you know, kind of painted this picture of. You know, am I for clean water? Am I for a cleaner Lake Okeechobee? Am I for a cleaner coast and all the waters around South Florida? Absolutely. And I think that there's always, you know, people involved with trying to make sure that we have the best water around in South Florida to protect all of our resources. I'm all for that. But I'm definitely not for somebody calling Lake Okeechobee a toxic wasteland.
What do you say to environmental activists trying to shine a spotlight on Lake Okeechobee?
Some of the things that have happened this last year were out of ordinary. You know, we had a tremendous, if you look, these are all factual things. I'm not some scientist, but I just know I live here. It rained more than it ever had rained ever in January. The lake came up 2 feet, which never happens. This year, for example, we haven't had any rain. There hasn't been a drop of rain. Like, my yard's going dry. So, you know, last year we had a phenomenon happen with the rain. Last year we had a phenomenon happen with a very, very warm winter, which sped all types of things up, processed. And these scientists will agree with that. So what happened last year isn't a normal thing with water discharges and some of the issues that, you know, people dealt with. It was kind of a, in my opinion, you know, a very rare thing, to be honest with you.
Could you speak to the information that is being generated on social and traditional media? What are some of the facts about the water quality of Lake Okeechobee?
Like, so I would just say to people that read posts and maybe listen to, you know, and there's a lot of people that are very upset on both coasts, you know, dealing with some of the issues that they're dealing with. And I get that. I'm sensitive to that. But Lake Okeechobee is a beautiful lake. It's not a toxic wasteland. That's what I would say to people, is it's a beautiful, beautiful place. And come out here to Lake Okeechobee and go fishing and enjoy this resource, because it is a very unique, one-of-a-kind lake.
Have local conditions had any negative impact on your business?
It hurts tourism all over South Florida, because, again, the way that they made it sound, it made it sound like, hey, it was a pretty common thing. It was happening all over the place. And so let me say this. The communities around this lake, we depend heavily on tourism. We depend heavily on getting people out to enjoy this resource. So, you know, we're very much involved in making sure Lake Okeechobee, and very passionate about keeping Lake Okeechobee protected and safe, and obviously keeping the water quality, you know, at its best. So we're all for that, and because that's what we depend on. You know, we we have a lot of tourism out in this area, believe it or not.
This is The Rotunda. I'm Tramell Gomes. All right, to look at the economics, we have the executive director of the Clewiston Chamber of Commerce. Hillary Highslope is in a unique position to understand the economic impact of Lake Okeechobee and the negative publicity surrounding the lake.
Lake Okeechobee is a tourism draw for our region down here in South Florida. We don't have the coastlines of the ocean and things like that. We have Lake Okeechobee, and it draws its own kind of tourism. It has its own type of individual that wants to come and be a part of what Lake Okeechobee has to offer. But I think that Scott hit the nail on the head. Have there been economic impacts due to the misinformation that's been going out? Absolutely. How would anybody think that there hasn't? There has absolutely been a negative impact to tourism, but not just on Lake Okeechobee, on the coastal regions as well. So I think that that's been very, very unfortunate for all the tourism in South Florida.
So the lake reaches deep into the economy in the Everglades agricultural area. Can you identify for our listeners all the segments it impacts?
I think there's a large misconception that we have a handful of large players, if you will, in the EAA. And that's just not entirely true. While, yes, there are some large corporations that do some farming down here, we also have many, many, many small private growers that are involved in the EAA. These are small, you know, small farmers. These are small businesses that depend on A, the land, and they depend on B, the water. It does not behoove the farmer any more than it behooves the tourist to have a nasty Lake Okeechobee. That's why it's so important that we try to stress to everyone that it is so important for the farmer to have clean water as well.
I know the Clewiston Chamber has long been concerned about the discharges of Lake Okeechobee during the periods of heavy rains. Can you tell us the Chamber's position on the best way to minimize those discharges?
The Chamber's position is that we need to secure the funding to complete the projects that are already on the book. We don't need to be bringing new projects to the table that are going to eat up all of the funding that it would take to complete the projects that are already underway, some more than halfway complete. We need to finish those projects, and that's how the Chamber stands.
Are there any aspects of Senator Negron's plans that you feel should be given more consideration as it relates to its impact on the local economy?
What people need to understand is that the state already has taken over 100,000 acres out of production already south of Lake Okeechobee. And not only is that jobs and, you know, that sort of economic impact, but you also have to take into account that the EAA as a whole feeds the nation half of their winter vegetables every year. That is a pretty substantial contribution to our food chain for the country as a whole. So I think that would be our biggest issue, is that no, we do not need to take more land out of production. That hurts our small farmers, that hurts our food supply, that hurts our tax roll. You know, there's just a multitude of effects that taking more land out of production, it just trickles all the way down into the economy of the local municipalities here.
All right, thanks to Scott Martin, champion fisherman, professional fishing guide, and host of the popular television program, The Scott Martin Challenge, and the executive director of the Clewiston Chamber of Commerce, Hillary Highslope, for joining the program. Keep track of The Rotunda on rotundapodcast.com. Also on Twitter at Rotunda Podcast, which is the same on Instagram, and you can find us on Facebook. Be sure to join us again next week right here for more stories about the people and issues shaping Florida politics. I'm Tramell Gomes.